screamed with each jostle of the gurney, his bones seeming to rattle in their joints. But that wasn't the worst of it, not by a desert league. No, the worst was the inferno smouldering just beneath his skin, a result of the copious amounts of Pison slime he'd come into contact with. The first moments after the Pison had exploded were still a blur, like a waking nightmare. The stars and moons above. Dozens of his people hovering over him, anxious to help, but not knowing how. Sonica taking charge, as usual, ordering fresh water to be pooled together. Shanti, dipping scraps of cloth in the water and washing him. Her touch so gentle, and yet the equivalent of knives piercing every pore in his skin. He'd screamed and had to be held down, but she never faltered, going about the work until it was complete. For a few blessed moments, he'd felt relief as a light desert breeze cooled his skin. And then the fires began again. Still, he was alive, and that was more than scores of his people could say. The final count was determined to be 96 souls lost, including 2 of the Black Tears, and over 200 injured. Jai wasn't the only one seriously hurt. A number of other gurneys were being carried by the others, and all of the surviving Tears had given up their steeds for those in greater need. "You owe me a story," Shanti said, her head bobbing over him with each stride she took. Her bare shoulders and arms were sweaty with exertion, her muscles taut against the inside of her skin. In the daylight, he could clearly see the bands of silver ringing her otherwise blue eyes. "I've got a good one," he said. "It's about how an ordinary man slew a red Pison, 100 times his size." He grimaced as the gurney bounced, his entire body screaming at him.
"I've heard that one," Shanti said. "But I did have one question. How did you know the fire root would ignite inside the snake's belly?"
"I didn't," Jai admitted. "But once in Fania, I saw a group of 100 hunters who had slain a red. They carried it into the city, parading it through the streets. They cut it open in front of everyone, and when they did, smoke poured out. The inside of the snake's belly was ringed in fire."
Shanti frowned. "I've never heard that before, and I'm usually an expert on anything to do with fire and smoke."
"I'm just glad it worked."
"You risked your life on a theory."
"You make it sound so brave."
"It was brave. The bravest thing I ever saw."
Jai shook his head, although he immediately wished he hadn't, as pain ripped through him at the movement.
"It was a foolish thing to do."
"Perhaps," Shanti agreed. "But it still took courage.
I have a long way to go before I slay any dragons."
"The red was close enough," Shanti said, smiling.
"Will it regrow?"
There were legends about the giant snake's ability to survive even when chopped in 2 pieces.
"No one really knows," Shanti said. "But I suspect it will. It is said they must be burned to ash before they are truly dead. In any case, it won't bother us for a while. Though it was a shame we had to leave all that fresh meat. I've heard the flesh of the red is as sweet as crab meat."
Jai didn't want to admit that it was, because he'd tasted it once, at a feast thrown by Emperor Hoza. "We didn't have time to linger." Shanti nodded. Tall spires of red rock appeared on either side of her as they entered the elevated lands to the east of the Bloody Canyons. She gritted her teeth under the strain of the first incline. Jai knew it was only going to get steeper.
"You're not planning to carry me all the way to the gates, are you?" he asked.
"No," she said. "But I'll go as far as I can." For some reason, her statement felt like an oath.
"Thank you," Jai said.
"For cleaning the Pison off my skin. For carrying me. It was the least I could do after you saved us all. Though I'll take an assist since it was my firefoot."
She smiled.
"But now, how about that story?"
Jai grimaced, but this time it wasn't from pain. He was hoping she'd forgotten. Then again, he'd wanted to tell her a couple of nights ago, and she'd opened up to him about her past. And maybe the pain of the telling would help him forget about his physical pain, at least for a while. The incline grew steeper, the red rocks thicker and taller,
rising to great points, cutting into the blue sky.
"My mother is a slave," Jai said.
Shanti flinched.
"That's not funny," she said.
"Sorry, I should have led with another line," he said. "But I wasn't japing. It's true."
"I don't understand."
Her coppery brows furrowed together, a few locks of hair blowing across her face.
"You are not Terran. Your skin isn't red, and your hair is too dark."
"I'm half. My father was Phoenician," Jai explained.
"That explains your eyes. They are too big for you to be full Phoenician, though your skin is tanned like the slavers."
"My father was a slave owner," Jai said.
"Oh. Oh. I'm sorry."
"It's not what you think. My father didn't force my mother, didn't rape her. They loved each other."
Shanti said nothing.
"It's true," Jai insisted. "I'm not clinging to some childhood fantasy."
"How do you know?"
"Because my father is..." The words stuck in his throat. It had been years since he'd spoken of his past.
"He's gone.
My father is gone."
Shanti licked her lips, a troubled expression working its way from her chin to her eyes, which reflected Jai's own sadness. "I'm sorry. You don't have to tell the rest. It is your story to lock away, if you wish."
"No," he said, reaching up to grab her wrist, just above where she held the edge of the gurney. The pain that lanced through his arm was fierce, but it was worth it.
"I'm ready to tell it.
My father was a slave owner, yes, but he never treated his slaves badly. That doesn't make it right, I know, and I don't condone it, but I can't hate him either. Despite her red skin and black eyes, I never even knew my mother was a slave until I was 5 name days old. I can still remember the agony in my father's eyes when he told me the truth. I wanted to hit him, to run away, to hide and never come out. But I didn't do any of that. I just fell into his arms and cried. Later, after I felt better, he told me he fell in love with her the moment she came into our household. A little later, she had me. Looking back, it seemed so obvious. She looked like all the other slaves, but she had her free will to do as she wished while in our household. She was an amazing dancer. Shanti's eyes widened.
Fen Sir, right?
She was the dancer you were talking about before, wasn't she?
Jai nodded.
She glowed when she danced. Literally. It was like Sarai was inside of her, or a part of her. My father and I couldn't take our eyes off of her when she danced.
What happened?
Jai tried to decide where to start the next part of his story. As a boy, father never let me leave the house. I didn't mind that much, because he taught me Fen Lu, which I loved. When company came over, I had to stay in my room. But I was young and ignorant to the ways of the world. Only his slaves knew about me, and they were commanded to keep his secret.
And yet secrets always find the light of day eventually, Shanti said.
Jai could see it in her eyes. She knew what was coming, or at least had a guess. Once you've experienced tragedy, you tend to look for it hiding behind every shadow. Jai knew that feeling all too well.
Yes.
One of the other neighboring household masters realized what was going on, what had happened. He told the Emperor about my mother, about me. The day I first laid eyes on Vin Hosa is branded in my mind like it was yesterday. He took my mother away. She didn't fight it, couldn't fight it. Not when Hosa commanded her with the voice of her original master, but my father did. He slew 4 of Hosa's men trying to get to the Emperor before they subdued him. Hosa could have stopped him, made him a slave. But he seemed to be enjoying watching my father's rage. Afterwards, he killed him for it. That's how I know my father loved my mother, regardless of the slave mark she bore. Shanti didn't need to say she was sorry again. Jai could see it in her silver blue eyes. They'd both lost those they loved.
regardless of whether he had the black tears to prove it.
What happened to her? To your mother?
Jai shrugged. I don't know. They took her away.
She's still a slave?
We are all still slaves, just like my people. I gave them free will, but they are still slaves, at least until we can get them out of Fane's.
What happened to you after Hoza took her? How did you become a master?
Jai flinched at the title. I was taken to a master training camp. I think Hoza thought I was young enough to still be rehabilitated, to think the way he did. They taught me and the other boys, Fenru, not to protect, to punish. Sometimes the things I saw in that place gives me nightmares. But it gets better with time. But I never forgot what Emperor Hoza did to my family. Never.
You want to save these people for your mother?
I don't know if I have a specific reason. Only that I must. Only that it's what I'm meant to do.
We all have our reasons for what we do. Revenge, atonement, anger, hate, love, a lost brother, mother, friend, a lost soul.
What is your reason?
The reasons don't matter, Shanti said, squinting. Only the results. I just want the Empire to burn to the ground with Hoza amongst the rubble. Why else would I haul all this fire root around with me?
I understand wanting to overthrow Hoza and set our people free, Jai said. But this is our home. We can't destroy it. We are outsiders, even you with your tanned skin.
This was never our home, Shanti said.
We've sent our stories to the gods. Now it's up to us to finish them. She crested the top of an incline and stared down the opposite side. The line of refugees stretched for leagues in both directions. A day later, Jai could walk again, though each step was painful. 2 days later, and he didn't hunch nearly as much. On day three, his skin began to peel off, flaking away with each breath of wind. Though his people were weary and saddened by the loss of their loved ones between the black and red rocks, they were fighters, as they had been their entire lives, never wavering as they pushed through the superheated mountain passes. More of the injured died along the way, and they buried them beneath cairns constructed of red stones. It was the best they could do, although it pained Jai greatly to know the Volgers would get to the bodies. The large raptors had been following them ever since the night with the red Pison, and Jai was certain their long-winged shadows wouldn't leave them until they breached the Great Wall to the north. On the fourth day, Jai noticed Axa sitting by himself when they stopped for their midday meal. He was holding his mirror and talking into it. The heat has addled his brain, Jai thought. When he went over to him, Axa thrust the mirror back into his skirt. I wanted to say thank you for carrying me for so long, Jai said. Like Shanti, Axa had refused to pass his burden on to any other, even after his arms began trembling with exertion. Joaquin had taunted the former master for a while, before growing bored of it.
Yes, master, Axa said.
I am not your master, he said. Not any more.
Master?
No. Jai shook his head. He said the words he'd said to all the others. I command you to act of your own free will, to make your own decisions, to walk your own paths. You are no longer chained to me. You will no longer call me master. You are your own master. Do you understand?
Yes.
Axa hesitated, as if the word master was on the tip of his tongue, like some kind of subconscious reflex. But then he closed his mouth. His eyes were still fully black, because, like the others, he was still technically a slave. If Vinhoza were to appear next to him and tell him to leap from a cliff, Axa would obey without question. He wasn't truly free, and never would be until they got past the bounds of Hoza's territory. Jai turned and walked away to find several of his people watching him with narrowed eyes.
Do you remember the time Master Axa beat me within an inch of my life?
one of them said, stepping forward. It was Joaquin again, his arms folded across his chest. He was a blunt man with a crooked nose and small, narrow eyes. Jai did remember. It was one of Axa's first days as a mine master in Garadia. From the beginning, Axa had rebelled against Jai's way of doing things. Jai had found Joaquin in a puddle of his own blood, ragged whip marks strewn across every bit of his skin. One of his eyes was swollen shut, and he was barely breathing. "Yes," Jai said.
"And now you set him free. Treat him like you treat the rest of us."
His eyes fired arrows of accusation across the space separating them. Several others nodded their agreement with his words. Others turned away, not wanting to get involved in the confrontation, but Jai had a feeling their thoughts would echo Joaquin's. "No," Jai said. "He's not like you. He's not my family. He's just a broken man in need of a second chance."
"And if he runs away and goes back to his true master? Hosa will destroy us all. Is that what you want?"
"You know I don't." More and more people noticed the raised voices, milling toward them to find out what was going on. Sonic of Aid and her black tears approached, but Jai waved them off. Like Axa, they were outsiders too, not connected to his people the way he was.
"We should beat him and leave him for the Vulgers," Joaquin said.
"We already decided he could come with us," Jai said. Joaquin pointed a finger at Jai.
"No, you decided. After your speech, who was going to vote against you?"
Jai recalled that there was one vote against him, Joaquin's. But he didn't think pointing that out would make a difference. "I won't leave anyone behind," he said.
"Oh, no? What about our dead? We left them, didn't we? The man doesn't belong here, and we can't let him go, so that leaves only one other option."
"We're not going to hurt him." Jai remained calm, still hoping he could resolve the situation with words. Being marked by Hosa changes a man. He's not the master he once was. He never will be again.
"And yet, at his soulless core, that's what he is."
"He carried Jai Jiru across the desert," a new voice said. Several people looked back, and Jai craned his neck to see who had spoken. The gathered crowd parted, and Jig and Viola's mother, Marella, approached. "Master Axa would never have done that. He hated Jai as much as he hated us. Do you not remember?" Joaquin shook his head.
"Do you not remember what he did to me? And I'm not the only one. That filth!"
He jabbed an angry finger at Axa, who was ignoring the entire thing, once more whispering into his mirror.
"Beat us, whipped us, belittled us, spat on us. And we're going to just forget all that, because he's finally been given a taste of his own treatment and made a slave."
His words were having an impact, Jai could see. More and more heads were nodding. If he didn't defuse the situation soon, the protests could turn violent. As it turned out, he didn't need to, because Marella and her two children stepped between them, facing Joaquin. Marella said, "We have trusted Jai Jiru for many years, and we must trust him still. He has never failed us, has never given us anything but a chance at a different life, a better life. Were you not there on the desert plains when the Red Pison was killing our people?" "I was there. I saw what Jai Jiru did. He risked his own life to save us. He did what no one else would, all for a bunch of worthless slaves." Jai tried to interject, but Marella waved him off. "My children have no father. That is Vinhosa's fault alone, but they look at Jai Jiru like a father. He is my family, and he is yours. Trust him, and find a better life. He will not let us down. He never has." Her words hung in the air, in a silence broken only by the wind whistling between the red rocks. And then Jig cried,
"Aye, what my mother said!"
The boy's unexpected shout seemed to break the spell over the crowd, and one by one they added their agreement, dispersing and returning to their meals, until only Marella, her children, and Joaquin remained. Joaquin said,
I will never forget the day you chose Axa over me.
Whack, come on. That's not what I... Jai started to say, but stopped when the man turned and walked away. Jai's chin dropped to his chest. Morella said,
He doesn't mean it. He's just angry.
I know. And yet the truth didn't make it hurt any less. Joaquin was once someone he could share a meal with, a man who would throw himself in front of a cave-in to protect another slave. A friend. Jai wondered if what he'd said was true. If, in a way, Jai had chosen Axa over him. If so, was it worth protecting someone who'd once hated him? Jai's justice mark burned on his heel.
Yes, it told him.
Axa is not the enemy. Not any more. To Jai's relief, there were no additional confrontations as they made their way through the Red Rocks. Two more of the injured from the Paizan attack died, bringing the total to over 100. Jai remembered every single one, and was determined to make their sacrifices count. When they descended the final slope and emerged from the red, blade-like spires they'd known for the last 7 days, Jai's heart leapt so high he could feel it in his throat. Because there they were, the Southron gates, rising tall and impenetrable in the distance, a final barrier to freedom. To the east, the waters of the burning sea sparkled in the mid-afternoon light. An ocean of desert was spread out before them. Directly ahead, between them and the gates, were the outlines of structures. A city. The great war city of Susa, home to thousands of Hoza's soldiers charged with defending the eastern portion of the wall. "We'll wait until nightfall," Sonica said, once more astride her horse, a beautiful black destrier she called Chainbreaker. "Then we make directly for the weakness in the wall your father told you about. Let's hope his words were true." "I know they were," Jai said. A ripple of emotion swelled within him at the thought of breaching the walls. His head wasn't in the clouds, however. He knew many would die during the final leg of their journey. "We will have to be silent on our approach. Tell everyone, the children especially. Those with small children will have to do everything in their power to keep them quiet. We'll pad each horse's hooves." Right on cue, Shanti's own horse rattled up, pulling its cart laden with several barrels filled with fireroot. "We'll pad the wheels of this rickety old cart, too." "Good," Jai said, nodding. "Do we have enough powder?" A few barrels had been lost during the Paizan attack, and another cracked open when it fell from the cart while traversing one particularly treacherous mountain pass. "Enough to crack several large stones," Shanti said. "So it will depend on how thick the first layer of the wall is, before reaching the hollow your father told you about." "It will have to be sufficient," Jai said. "But we also need to save enough to blast through the other side." Shanti nodded. "Leave it to me. Or did you want to handle the fire route? After the last time, I think you may have a talent for blowing things up." She grinned. "I'll pass," Jai said, grinning back. "I'd hate to risk my new skin." Over the last few days, more of his flesh had peeled off, leaving his arms, chest, and back patchy and marbled. "Back into the rocks," Sonica said. "We need to rest and prepare for tonight." As the tears spread out through the people to pass along the orders and the plan, Jai gazed at the point where the burning sea met the longest river in the Four Kingdoms, the Spear. Just beyond, he swore he saw a ray of sunlight glint off of something metallic. But then it was gone. A trick of the eye, he thought. Nothing more. He turned and followed Sonica and the others back up the path to the cover of the rocks. Once more, he would offer his people the choice to turn back, to hide or return to Fenrir, or take whatever they thought was the best course. He suspected none would accept his offer, a thought that thrilled and terrified him. On the morrow, many would die. "The sacrifice for freedom," he thought.
31. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhea Loren. Rhea the Righteous wasn't just the title her people had given her. No, It was more than that. It was her legend, her mark, a name that would follow her after death into the annals of history. Songs would be sung about her. Stories would be told, moulding and changing and becoming even more wondrous than the already wondrous truth. Though she was far from death, she knew she would never really die, a thought that pleased her more than anything else. To spur her legend on, Rhea released 12 northern prisoners, each of whom looked ready to piss in their britches just looking at her. They were given safe passage across the bay to Blackstone, where they would tell their tale, moving through the kingdom until they reached Lord Griswold at Castle Hill, where they would inform him of the destruction of his entire force. No streams would be sent. No. She wanted the news to move slowly, methodically, like a painful disease. She wished she could be there to see the look on his face. Additionally, Rhea enlisted the help of Western messengers, who would ride south and east, spreading the news of her pet sea monster and the North's demise. She would use fear like a spear, striking the first blow on her remaining enemies' hearts from a distance. And then she would come for them to take their heads. But first she had a distasteful but necessary task to attend to. The dungeon master opened the door for her as she approached. Ever since Rathos' Revenge, which is what the battle had been named by the bards, who were already singing of her glory, Rhea had worn her battle armor whenever in public. She didn't want her people to think one victory, regardless of how decisive it had been, was the end of the war. She even refused to have any of the metal cleaned or polished, using the bloodstains as a reminder that she had been there like any of the other soldiers, that she was one of them, willing to die for Roth's righteous cause. Now she said nothing to the grisly old dungeon master, for he didn't have any ears to hear it. She simply nodded at him and continued onward, her boots echoing down the corridor. She wrinkled her nose when she remembered the last time she'd entered the dungeons, to see her twin siblings. Thankfully, she wasn't here to see them today. No, she was here to visit another family member. Ennis lifted his chin when she stopped before his cell. "My queen," he said. "Roth," Rhea thought. "My cousin is a fool, yes, but an unflinchingly loyal fool. Shame I can't keep him around." "Dear Ennis," she said. "How I've missed you." It wasn't entirely a lie. The truth was, she missed her never-ending arguments with her cousin, his constant attempts at chivalry, and even his misplaced sense of honour. She missed her whipped dog, too, the Fury. But she could eventually be replaced. Not Ennis. Once he was gone, she wouldn't have a single cousin left in Night's End. Apparently Ennis's three living siblings had fled the castle moments before the battle with the North had begun, expecting the North to win. She pushed aside the sadness and loneliness that was always there on the fringes of her heart, waiting to clamp down.
"And I, you, Rhea?"
The way he said her name was too tender, too familiar, considering he was the one behind bars. His voice scraped against her nerves.
"You still love me? Even after I've had you imprisoned for a fortnight?" "I will always love you, cousin. I have always loved you, since the day you were born, even with your faults." "Didn't you hear? I have no faults."
In addition to the numerous titles bestowed upon her, the righteous, the brave, the pure, the guide, the faultless had been added by her people.
"We all have faults," Ennis said. "Mine was being too weak to convince you otherwise. And treason. Don't forget that one," Rhea mused, drumming her fingernails on one of the iron bars. Her cold exterior was the only true armor she had left.
"I can't lose you too, Ennis. Why, oh why, did you have to disobey me in battle? If treason is protecting one's queen from certain death, then I am the greatest traitor in the realm," Ennis said. "Roth, does he always have to make things so difficult? You disobeyed a direct command from your queen. You almost cost us the battle. If not for my actions, we would never have lost half the fleet,
would never have sacrificed thousands of lives to satisfy your need for destruction, would never have summoned a demon from the depths of the sea."
Rhea clucked her tongue, anger pushing away the sadness.
"Now you decide to grow bold, cousin? It's too late. Your words are chaff in fields that have already been harvested, and your soul is lost to me. I fear it was always lost to you."
"It wasn't. It isn't."
"Perhaps," Rhea said. "But I tire of this conversation. I am giving you a choice, Ennis, only because I care about you still, even when you are like this."
"What choice is there in death?"
he asked. And for the first time the fight had gone out of him, his shoulders sagging, as if the weight of his own thoughts were too much for him to bear, the weight of the world. Rhea felt sorry for him, but not as sorry as she felt for herself, for having to do this. He spat the next words out the same way he'd spat at the feet of their enemies on the deck of Roth's Chosen, before their last stand.
"Guillotine or noose? Blade to the heart or to the head? Whatever I choose, I go to meet my Maker in whatever heaven Roth sees fit to honour me with."
"Unless you choose life," Rhea said.
Ennis blinked in surprise.
"Good. Let him be shocked."
She remembered another name given to her. The Merciful. It was one of her favourites, even if it was a lie. She wasn't given mercy under the Fury's blade. Why should she offer it herself?
"What life?"
her cousin asked.
"Banishment. To Crimea, or the hinterlands, or Tarragon, or even the unexplored oceans to the east, if you can survive the trek through enemy countryside. As long as I am alive, as long as I am queen, you will not set foot in the Four Kingdoms again."
He stood gingerly, favouring his right leg, his arm and shoulder still heavily wrapped, walked over to the bars, reached through, taking her hand with tender fingers, like she was as delicate as glass.
"I choose death," he said.
Despite all her bravado and bluster, Rhea's heart sank. Rhea's command had been simple.
"Bring me everything you can find on the Western Oracle from the archives."
Though the archivist's jaws had dropped open, they'd scurried away to do their duty. However, what they came back with was disappointing. 2 books, 3 scrolls, and a half-burned section of parchment that was nearly illegible. Still, Rhea was glad for the distraction after her meeting with Ennis hadn't gone as planned. She opened the 1st book, an abridged history of the 4th century after the Crimean discovery of the 4 kingdoms. The archivists had been thorough, identifying the pages of interest with white ribbon and using a removable grey chalk to highlight the relevant passages. Only 2 pages had ribbons. Only 1 passage on each page was marked. They were frustratingly brief. Circa 350. A woman who later became known as the Western Oracle prophesies of the coming of the fate marks, which will return peace to the 4 kingdoms. The 1st passage, while short, was odd. Everyone knew that the 100 Years' War didn't begin until the 5th century. Before then, there was relative peace in the 4 kingdoms, which, in a way, meant the Oracle had predicted the war 50 years before it began. It said nothing of her being one of the original Furies, however, like she'd been told. The next passage was equally short. Circa 352. Western Oracle is charged with heresy and sorcery after the 1st marks appear on newborn children, giving them strange and unnatural powers. She is sentenced to death, as well as those who are marked. Rhea noticed a subtle distinction. The Western Oracle was sentenced to death, but there was nothing about the sentence being carried out. Maybe it was nothing. And even if she wasn't executed, that was nearly 2 centuries ago, so she'd have died of natural causes already. Still, Rhea opened the next book, which only had 1 passage marked. A prophecy by the Western Oracle. "The fate marked shall arise, and one marked with death, the king's bane, shall bring about the death of 8 rulers, cleansing the realm. And then the peacemaker shall come, and with him life."
King's Bane. The demon who'd stalked this very castle, murdering guardsmen at will, eventually slitting her father's throat. Rulers were dying. Her father. The dread king in the north. King Ironclad at Raiders Pass. There were even rumours being streamed that Empress Sun Sands had been killed under strange circumstances in Calypso. One ruler was nothing. Two? A coincidence. But four? All within a short time period. She slammed the book shut and unfurled the first scroll, which contained a series of quotes scribed during a trial. The Western Oracle's trial, Rhea noted. Again, the relevant spot was highlighted with grey dust. She'd have to commend the archivists later. For I am but a servant of the Almighty, our Lord and God Wrath, who is of many names, including the Terran name Absence, who I have communed with on my travels. They call me a witch. They call me a sorceress. They call me the Western Oracle. But I am nothing. I am a woman. I am a servant. I create what I am told to create. Rhea breathed in. The Western Oracle hadn't just claimed to know of the coming of the Marks. No. She claimed to have created them. Rhea reread the passage, and then slowly rolled up the scroll, tying it carefully with the ribbon. Why doesn't anyone talk about this? She knew the answer. If people thought the Oracle had created the Marks in the name of Wrath, or at least claimed to, they might begin to question whether the Marks were truly evil. The Furia and the Loren King at the time had declared them sinful, given them the name Sin Marks. Rhea was surprised this scroll had survived. Clearly, based on how few references there were to the Oracle in the archives, most documents had been destroyed. Greedily, she untied the second scroll. The entire top portion was wrinkled and damaged, the ink long smudged away as if it had been immersed in water. Only one passage remained, and most of it was illegible. The Oracle's son, not found, though certain he located before Moon's next kiss, Sky. The Western Oracle had a son. Why didn't anyone talk about him? Who was he? Was he executed too? Was he a sorcerer like his mother? Rhea felt supercharged, like she was closing in on some important truth. Something once lost, hidden behind misinformation and lies. The third scroll felt more precious than gold in her hands as she unfurled it. Disappointment swam like river trout in her stomach. The entire scroll was destroyed, save for one word. Oracle. She didn't take the care with this scroll that she had with the others, crumpling it, tearing it, tossing the remains into the fire. Why would anyone even keep such a pointless scroll? Maybe the archivists weren't as helpful as she thought. The last document was black and crisp around the edges. Clearly it had been tossed into a fire and then quickly retrieved, the flames stamped out before they could consume the entire document. Still, most of it was unusable. On the top portion, she could just make out who it was addressed to, as well as part of the year. Circa 370. Rhea knew there was no way this document was from the year 37, so it must be 37-something, long after the Oracle had been sentenced to death for her crimes. It was addressed to King Loren, and it began with, "Hear my words." Everything after that was lost. The page eaten through the middle by the flames, leaving it charred and full of holes. There were, however, a few words toward the bottom. She lives on. She will never die. Will you? The letter was unsigned. Something occurred to Rhea. How did the archivists know this letter had anything to do with the Western Oracle if it made no reference to her? She realized something else. After being burned and then nearly 2 centuries passing, wouldn't the paper be practically falling apart? Instead, it was in reasonable condition, other than the scorched part. She sniffed it. It smelled like fire, ashy. Wouldn't the scent have worn off years ago?
As she marched into the archivist's office, Rhea was a storm, her armour seeming to spark with lightning, her expression a dark cloud. Crimson raindrops fell around her sides, the furia. "Stop," she said. The archivist spun around, the evidence of her sins held in her hands, which were shaking. Smoke poured from the hearth, which blazed with fire, flames licking the sides of a pile of books and scrolls, cresting the top, consuming them. As her furia grabbed the woman, wrenching the unburned documents from her hands, Rhea wondered where the other archivist was. Then she saw a leg sticking out from behind an old wooden desk. Rhea barely noticed when one of the furias slit the first archivist's throat, her body thumping to the floor, because she was peering around the corner of the desk. The other archivist had a knife buried in her chest, her dead hands gripping it as if she'd tried to pull it out before she died. Instinctively, Rhea knew the woman had known she was already dead, so she'd killed herself. Why? The question thundered through her chest. Secrets and lies. All for what? Rhea frowned, half watching as the Furia carried the dead women away. If the marks were known to be created by Roth, or at least by his command, the Western Oracle would be more akin to a priestess than a dark sorceress. The fury she originally was. But what would that mean? The facts lined up in Rhea's head. The marks were not exclusive to the Western Kingdom. No, they were pervasive to the Four Kingdoms, appearing in equal measure in each realm. The West simply killed those that bore them. But if the marks and their bearers were known to not be evil, then why would Roth give them to the barbarian Southrunners, to the Eastern Witches? To the godless sinners of the North. And if the Furia had been killing mark-bearers for no reason... Secrets and lies, Rhea thought. This can't get out, or there will be chaos. Bring whatever survived to my chambers, she commanded the Furia who remained.
32. The Western Kingdom, the Grasslands. Rhone Loren. Rhone and his companions soon learned that the grasslands of the Western Kingdom were not friendly to strangers, despite the numerous farms that dotted the landscape, with herds of cattle and flocks of sheep grazing across the prairie. The first farmer they spied fled to his dwelling, barring the door and peering out at them through a smudged window.
"Go away!" he shouted. "Don't want no trouble!"
After they left, Gwen touched the dark headscarf she'd donned at the first sign of civilization.
"Is my hair showing?"
Rhone started to examine the edges of the fabric, looking for gaps, but Gareth pushed him aside.
"Let me," he said.
Rhone frowned, but didn't argue. It was the first thing Gareth had said to him since they left the tangle, so he took it as a small victory. Instead, he focused on the graceful but strong lines of Gwendolyn's face, which was partially hidden beneath the shadow of the scarf. It was like the covering only made her more beautiful, more mysterious. He desperately wanted to reach over and touch her chin, her cheek, run his fingers along her skin, move closer, his lips parting.
"You're covered,"
Gareth announced, cutting off Rhone's thoughts. He blushed slightly when Gwendolyn lifted the scarf and noticed him staring at her. The hint of a smile played on her lips, as if she could see inside his head, which only made his cheeks grow warmer. Rhone wondered how different things might be if Gareth hadn't reacted to their kiss the way he had. Would he still be interested in Gwen? Would he be torn between them both? But that wasn't a problem any more, and he couldn't dwell on a man who clearly had no interest in him, right? Regardless, he was tired of hiding his feelings, which were like a turtle stuck in a shell trying to burst free. But he couldn't let them, for he didn't want to further alienate Gareth when he was clearly dealing with his own internal struggles. Also, Rhone wasn't certain whether Gareth had ever had true feelings for Gwen, or if his talk of her beauty was merely a long-running jape to him. Also, despite his attempts to forget about the prince, he couldn't. Not when every time he saw him, he felt pulled in different directions. Sometimes he felt like a stranger. Sometimes like a close friend. Sometimes like something more. All those thoughts passed through his mind in a second.
"He doesn't want you anyway, so forget about him,"
he urged himself once more. "He speaks of his conquests of women like victories in battle. And you have Gwen to think about now." They continued on, feeling the farmer's eyes watching them until they passed out of sight. The next farm they came to earned them a similar result. This time, the farmer's entire family was outdoors, working the fields, when they were spotted. The farmer ushered his family inside, dropping tools as they ran.
"We mean you no harm," Roan said through the door.
He wondered what sort of travellers passed by that they should be so frightened. When there was no response from inside, Roan turned to Gareth and said,
"Do you have only Eastern coin?"
He was certain the iron shields of the East would be worth little and less here in the West. Gareth shook his head, riffling through a large pouch that jingled when he moved it. He extracted a gold disc, unprinted on both sides. Neutral currency. Used during periods when the war was at a standstill and inter-kingdom trade was possible. Roan placed the coin in front of the door and said,
"I'm leaving one golden for your trouble, and we're taking one of your fat sheep and a basket of vegetables."
Gwen grabbed his arm.
"You've overpaid," she hissed.
"It will sustain us until Restor," he said, "so it's worth the gold." Plus, it was only fair, considering the farmer didn't exactly agree to the transaction. They were heading back toward the sheep when Roan heard the door creak open. The farmer peeked out.
"Take a dozen eggs from the henhouse, too," he said.
"Thank you," Roan said.
"Don't thank me. Just don't come back."
The man snatched the coin off the ground and started to duck back inside, but Roan quickly asked, "Who are you so scared of?" The man paused, frowning.
"You're not from the West, are you?"
It wasn't a question, and Roan froze.
"I'm a fool," he thought.
Asking a question like that in Restor could get them killed.
"We have been travelling a long time," he said neutrally.
The man squinted at them, though the sun was hidden behind puffy white clouds.
"The West used to be a safe place. The Furia patrolled the Western Road. They protected farmers like me, like my neighbours. But ever since King Gil Loren was killed, we haven't seen one of the Furia in a fortnight, maybe longer. Marauders have taken over. They do not fear wrath. They do not fear anything. They drink and they steal and they use our women."
Roan realized he had stiffened when the man said his father's name. Slowly, he let out the breath trapped in his throat.
"I'm sorry, but we are not marauders. Still, we don't know you. And two men travelling with a woman," he motioned toward Gwen, "is most unusual. Be on your way now."
Roan nodded, but the door had already closed. When he turned back toward Gwen and Gareth, both their mouths were pulled into thin lines.
"What does it mean?" he asked.
"Why aren't the Furia patrolling the West?"
Gwen said, "Isn't it obvious?"
"The West is preparing for war," Gareth finished.
After weeks of nothing but stale bread, boiled roots, and overripe berries, the fried eggs and stewed carrots, onions, and tomatoes were the best thing Roan had ever tasted, and, based on the ecstasy on his friends' faces, apparently the meat was equally tasty.
"You still don't eat meat,"
Gareth commented, his mouth half full.
The meal had done what Roan and Gwen had been unable to do, loosen his tongue.
"No."
"But Calypsians eat meat."
"Yes."
"Fine."
Gareth took an exaggerated bite of meat, letting juice dribble down his chin. Roan had to look away.
"Have your secrets. You've got enough of them."
He grabbed a sheep's leg and stalked off.
"What is with him?"
Roan said.
"He has demons, just like the rest of us,"
Gwen said.
"Give him time."
Roan wasn't certain time was the answer, but he sat and finished his meal, mulling over what Gareth had said about his secrets, wondering if he was referring to his skin mark, his lineage, or something still hidden, like his feelings for Gwendolyn. It wasn't until after Roan and Gwen laid down to sleep that he heard Gareth return. Roan cracked his eyelids and watched as Gareth snapped the leg bone in half, sucked out the marrow, and then tossed the remains in the fire, before laying down to sleep.
"The Western Road," Gareth declared brightly the next day, when they finally stumbled upon a long, narrow path of smooth stones and dirt, winding its way both to the east and the west.
"I thought it would be more impressive," Roan said.
"You should see the Bridge of Triumph," Gareth muttered, but didn't elucidate further. They stepped onto the road, gazing along the path. Roan half expected to spy a cloud of dust moving toward them, a dozen marauders riding full tilt in their direction. But nothing moved. The road was quiet and empty. Without a word, they headed west, travelling faster than before on the even terrain. The first town they came to was shuttered. An untethered horse roamed aimlessly between the wooden structures, nibbling on tufts of grass sprouting up. He was white with black speckles, and though his ribs were starting to show, he was still well-muscled and strong-looking. Roan patted his head and fed him a carrot, which he gobbled up.
"Whoa, boy," he said. "What happened here?"
The horse only sneezed in response. They found the first body outside the inn. She was young, perhaps 13, maybe a year or two younger or older. Her throat had been cut. Roan's stomach roiled. Though he didn't want to look too closely, based on the lack of decomposition, she'd been killed recently.
"This isn't the West I was told about," he said.
"Who are the savages now?"
Gwen said, but there wasn't venom in her tone, only sadness. Gareth said,
"Every kingdom has bad people. They hide, they wait, and as soon as the rulers begin to unravel, they pounce."
"Even the East?" Roan asked, turning away from the body, trying not to gag.
"Of course," Gareth said. "Our prisons are used as much as any."
There were more bodies inside the inn. The tavern, too. No one was spared. There were broken schooners everywhere. The floors were sticky with ale and blood. Dry goods had been spilled between the pantry and the door. The larder was empty, as was the mead cellar.
"They took everything," Gwen said. "Marauders."
"But why did they have to kill everyone?" Roan asked.
"Why does a wolf hunt a rabbit?" Gareth said.
"Because it's what he is."
Roan shook his head. Humans were not wolves. And yet, it was the only explanation for what was all around him.
"We should bury them," he said.
"There are too many,"
Gwen said.
"It will take 3 days.
"We can burn them," Gareth said.
"No,"
Roan snapped.
"No."
Gwen ducked her head to catch his eye.
"We will do it, Gareth and I. You load that horse up with our bags. Water him. We'll take him with us."
Roan hadn't told anyone about the 2 children his guardian had burned in Calypso, a moment that had changed his life forever. And yet Gwen seemed to know exactly what he needed at this particular moment. He nodded.
"I can help you with the bodies. Then I'll see to the horse."
"More secrets," Gareth muttered, refusing to meet Roan's eye. They used a cart to gather the bodies in the center of the dead village, finishing the funeral pyre off with wooden doors and shutters from the abandoned structures. Gwen and Gareth stayed to light the pyre and watch it burn, while Roan took care of the horse. Though he knew little about horses, he was no longer uncomfortable with them, ever since his long ride from Barrenwood to Feria and on to Raiders Pass. It was strange how the memory of the journey was already slipping away into a hazy past. He found a brush inside the stables and used it to comb the knots out of the mare's pearl-white mane.
"You're a clever horse, aren't you?"
he said. "They took all the other horses, but not you. You hid from them."
"I? Am I right?"
The horse chuffed in response. Next he found rainwater that had gathered in an open barrel. The horse lapped at it greedily. Finally he slung the bags over its back, tying them with ropes under its midsection. The marauders had left no saddles, they were far too valuable, but Roan located a thick blanket, which he draped over the horse's back.
"We're not going to ride you until you get your strength back,"
he promised. The horse whinnied.
"We should call him Horse,"
Gareth said from behind.
Original, Roan said. The horse? Roan couldn't do this, not right now. Couldn't laugh and pretend everything was the same as it had been before the battle at Raiders Pass. The prince had changed too much, was too volatile. I'm sorry I kept so many secrets from you. Before. I didn't know you. I couldn't read you.
And now?
Now I'm worried about you.
Don't.
You're my friend.
Right. My friend. We're all friends here. I only came with you because I had nowhere else to go.
The words were knives, but Roan didn't care. He let them cut him to ribbons, taking a step closer. After we find the Western Archives and get what we're looking for, we'll return to the East with you. We'll make this right. Until he said it, Roan didn't know he was considering it. I am. I will. But Gareth only mock-laughed.
Right. The King of the West will convince the East to accept their fool-brained prince back into the fold, no questions asked. Thanks, but no thanks.
Roan said, Gareth, but he'd already left the stables. Roan stood there for a long time, just breathing, stroking the horse's mane. At some point, he realized it wasn't only his breath he was hearing. He whirled around, letting out a startled sound. The horse whined beside him, perhaps sensing his unease. The boy he'd first met at Raiders Pass in the midst of the battle stood before him, the one who'd called him the peacemaker, the one who'd killed Guy Ironclad, the one who'd tried to kill Gareth Ironclad.
"Kingsbane,"
Roan breathed. He took a step back. Roan was unarmed, and he could see the flash of a knife as the boy shifted his stance.
"You're a hard person to find. I can't sense you the way I can the others. It's taken me 3 days, and I travel fast."
His words were too light for what he was, what Roan had seen him do. Roan took another step back.
"What do you want?" "Don't be scared. I only want to talk," Bane said.
"Talk?" The word sounded foreign after what had transpired the last time they'd met.
"Yes. We're on the same side here. We always have been. We're part of the same prophecy. My goal is peace in the Four Kingdoms, and you are the peacemaker. We are two sides of the same coin. Don't you see?"
Roan didn't see anything but a troubled boy who'd tried to kill one of his friends.
"You're killing innocent people," he said.
The boy frowned, his pale scalp wrinkling.
"Innocent? No one is innocent these days. Least of all the monarchies that have driven their people to more than a century of war. That man you saved, King Gareth Ironclad, he is a murderer, just like his father was. You don't know what he is. He's my friend." "Friend? How can you make peace by befriending the enemy?"
The question pounded on the core of the ideals Roan had clung to his entire life, as he'd watched the Four Kingdoms tear themselves apart, as the Southern Empire had become embroiled in civil war. "That's the only way to make peace."
"No, you're wrong, friend. I'm not your friend." "Then I'm afraid I'll have to kill you, too."
Roan backed up another step.
"I will not fight you," he said. "I am done with violence. I didn't mean today."
Bane seemed amused by Roan's response to his threat, his lips curling on both sides.
"I'm giving you a second chance to do the right thing. If you kill Gareth Ironclad, I won't have to. He's already refused to be king. He's not your next target."
As the words spilled from Roan's tongue, they tasted bitter. How could he protect Gareth while potentially sentencing his brother to death? And yet he knew he would do the same thing 100 times in a row if necessary. 1,000 times.
"Doesn't matter," Bane said. "He's still the heir. He's still the threat to peace."
Roan thought of his broken, troubled friend. "He is no threat. I don't know if he ever was, but he's not any more.
It doesn't change what I have to do.
8 monarchs have to die. How many are dead so far?
Roan knew of at least 3.
4,
Bane said.
Sun Sans is dead.
What? Roan knew he shouldn't be surprised by the news, not after having seen what Bane was capable of. And yet,